This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Should schools share teachers? It's a model in the UK and a trial is about to start here in Tassie. So in theory, the model means that schools share teachers and techniques to deal with different types of behaviour. Principals work together to pass on knowledge and experience, all with the aim that higher performing schools lift up underperforming schools. So what do you think? How would it work? I mean, is it a good idea, especially in regional areas where resources and specialist teachers may be hard to find? So if you're a teacher or a principal, would you be happy to pool resources with other schools in the area? And also coming up this hour, do you have a pile of old-fashioned patterns? Well, they're about to become almost impossible to buy. So you may be sitting on a gold mine.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So Tassie is about to trial a model that allows schools to work together sharing resources, and that includes staff, information, knowledge, mentorship. It's based on a UK model and it's all about trying to bring up underperforming schools with all types of improvement and sharing of knowledge. So how does it work? And would something like this work here in Victoria? Well, Mike Baird is the CEO of McKinnon Institute and, of course, the former Premier of New South Wales. And the McKinnon Institute, for those who don't know, is a not-for-profit organisation that's all sort of about strengthening democracy. Mike, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Thank you, Michelle.
First things first, can you kind of explain what this model from the UK is?
Yeah, well, it's a simple one. It's a family of schools that work under a shared leadership team. You know, so there's a leader of that team, and there's a number of leaders across it. And the aim is simple: it's to bring in high performing schools to help those schools that aren't performing as well, and to try and lift them up from one to the other. So you're giving an opportunity to take the ministry burden off teachers and principals. So I used to hear that a lot from teachers and principals, that the administrative burdens used to weigh them down. Teachers just want to teach and principals just want to lead. They want to have an opportunity to innovate and to think how they can work. So what it does is it shares opportunities of curriculum. So how do you sort of undertake and teach particular programs? You kind of share best practice there. You share best practice in terms of professional development, and that gives teachers a chance to learn and grow in their roles, and it gives a collective ownership across the whole organisation, the whole MSO. You know, every teacher and principal within it, and, you know, in the UK there's up to 20, 30 schools, even more, but, you know, around about 30 to 50 schools is kind of the Goldilocks size, it seems. And every teacher in that feels an ownership of every student within it.
That's a lot of schools.
Yeah, it starts small. Some are more. Some are. It just depends on the size, and that's the point. You've got to work out what works in terms of size and location. And you spoke about regional areas. You know, regional schools are often left by themselves. You know, without expertise and without much help and support. Whereas this kind of gives them that. It gives them tools, support, expertise as they seek to drive results.
So, Mike Baird, is this something then, is it about teachers and principals sort of coming together weekly or monthly or whatever it may be and sharing ideas and concepts and what works for them, what doesn't? Or is it about physically sharing teachers in classrooms?
It's what works in a particular trust. I mean, there's both examples of those. So, you know, some it's just, you know, sharing best practice. So particular course and program, here is the curriculum, that can be used. You know, some individual teachers obviously like to do it all themselves, but, you know, others, you know, are happy to use kind of best practice. So this best practice is what you're striving for. I mean, you know, there are many schools that are hitting it out of the park, and they've got a great leaders, great teachers. Other schools that aren't performing, they've got great teachers and leaders, but they just need support to grow in a way that other schools success. Like anything in life, you know, you can learn from those that are doing things well, and, you know, creates a culture of learning and growing together.
It's interesting, there's already texts coming in saying this is already happening in Nathalia, where NHS and St Mary's used to share teachers and classrooms. That's from Jason. Others saying this is already really common in my region, particularly in music education. I was appointed to be the shared music specialist between four rural schools back in 1987. That's from Gail. I wonder, though, what will the role of, and given that you're the former New South Wales Premier now, you're with McKinnon Institute, which is more of a sort of a not-for-profit looking at equality across these sectors, how do you formalise this? Because if it's already sort of happening in an ad hoc way, what role should state governments have to add a formula to this? Or will that kind of kill the buzz? Will that go against people having ownership of the model that works for them?
No, so what's happening now is there is a form of loose collaboration that takes place, and, you know, that music example is a good example where that's happening amongst various schools. In terms of sharing best practice, you know, there is that sense that groups of schools are encouraged to share. What this does, it's much more focused, much more aligned. So there is a leadership team that sits above the schools, and every single part of that school kind of works with all other schools and that leadership team to drive performance. So it's a formalised structure that actually, you know, brings best practice, and that leadership team looks from one school to the other and has an opportunity to support the teachers and the principals as needed. So it's different to the collaboration that's going on, but you're right, there's an empowerment to that leadership team and that group of schools to do what they think is best for each student in that region. And look, this is
so there's no role then from the state government. I mean, there's one here saying there's just so many bureaucrats in the education department. Why aren't they allocated out as dedicated support for each of the schools? There will be, if Victoria was to take up a trial like Tassie is about to take up, there would be no structure or involvement from the state governments?
No. It's owned by the state governments, of course. Yeah, it's owned by the state governments. So the state governments,
they would coordinate it all.
They would coordinate it, and they would drive it.
So does that then take the idea of trying to get, let's put a regional lens over this? There's already huge issues about getting teachers to, no matter what part of Australia you're in, to get teachers and specialist teachers, music teachers is a perfect example, science teachers, you name it, to get teachers to regional and rural areas. Will this make it harder or easier and entice teachers to go to these areas, or will it take the pressure off incentives to get teachers into those areas?
My sense, it makes it easier because there's a whole group of schools that, you know, not all, you know, have to be regional, obviously. And in that group of schools, there's an ownership of every single student. So teachers would be encouraged to use their expertise in, you know, where it's required, and if there's a shortfall, you know, that culture. And that's what we saw, having looked at it in the UK. Grattan Institute did some research and analysis, you know, of these multi-academy trusts, they're called in the UK, multi-school organisation here, which we're sort of piloting in Tasmania. But what we saw was this real ownership of student outcomes from one part of the trust or the MSO to another, and that's what you're trying to drive. So it's looking at the results. I mean, more than 20 years ago, in terms of the successful UK multi-academy trusts, 70% of schools who had been persistently underperforming were now in good or outstanding after joining trusts like that. So that's what we do at McKinnon. Like, we look at opportunities around the world and say, well, actually,
what's working?
Is there an opportunity
here? I find it fascinating. I mean, when we talk about resources and the sharing of resources, we've had multiple conversations on this program around basketball courts and footy grounds and swimming pools and sharing those resources either with other schools or with the general public. But then when you talk about the sharing of minds and of ideas and of mentorship, I just wonder how that will work in theory. Mike Baird, thank you so much for your time and your insights into this. What do you think? Should Victoria go down the same line as Tassie and start a trial?
Oh, look, that's obviously a matter for Victoria. But what we're excited about is that you can see a great idea globally, and you can see it delivering incredible results, and all of us are motivated to see better kind of outcomes for our kids. But Tasmania is undertaking a trial, so we will see that. Other governments will obviously have the chance to look at it and consider that in their own context. But the motivation's pure and simple. How can we help our teachers and principal deliver the best possible results for our kids? And, you know, we think that's a really worthy cause.
Good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks for the time.
Mike Baird, the CEO of McKinnon Institute, of course, the former Premier of New South Wales. What do you think? I mean, it feels like on text anyhow that it's already sort of happening to a certain degree. Joanne, who's in Ferny Creek, says this could actually work really well in the Dandenongs where there are several small primary schools. That's where I can see it working, and especially when you see small schools in regional areas, and I'm talking hyper small schools, when they shut down. And, you know, the principal is also the teacher and there might only be one other teacher. How would that work? And does everyone always come out on top? If you're a teacher, if you're a principal, if you've done something like this, I'd love to hear from you. Gail's in Bendigo. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Rochelle. Yes, I was that shared music specialist.
And
it was across the four rural schools. One of them was tiny, a one-teacher school at Sutton Grange, which is no longer. But one of the larger schools, my larger school was my base school, and I just travelled to that a couple of days. And then there was Elphingstone and Shuton on the other days.
And this was back in the 80s. Is that right, Gail?
That's right. And I'd like to reflect, too, on the brilliant work of Richard Gill, who found these music mentors to go around and actually support people who were teaching music in schools.
See, I feel so conflicted about this because, Gail, I am so passionate about music being taught in schools, and not so that kids go on to become musicians. It's because of the joy and the foundations that music brings to us. And we know that music teachers are a shortage, that some schools don't have instruments, let alone teachers. If you were to share yourself around, on one side, I think, great, those little schools are getting a music teacher. But at the same time, I also think every school should have its own music teacher. So is that just impossible?
It is impossible.
Yeah,
it won't
right.
happen. And it's about the priorities at the top. It's the first thing to be cut.
I know.
And I've seen it so many times. It's heartbreaking. But I agree with you. When children are engaged and having fun, that's when they're learning. And it can be give such solace to so many students. But I've got friends now who are teaching music across more than one school. And it gets that expertise into those schools. I just wish it was more of a priority like you.
Yeah, I agree, Gail. Thank you. This from Steph Risch. As a teaching student, I've been taught that current best practice professional development involves teachers taking the initiative and collaborating with schools to identify key problems in the classroom and student outcomes and consulting experts and sharing expertise to learn together. Well, I understood half of that, Steph, but thank you. I do get it in theory. Alison's in Blackburn. Hi, Alison.
Oh, hi.
What do you think? Are you a teacher?
I'm a casual relief teacher now.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked under that model in 2022. I was a government tutor at a school that had two campuses, so I had to travel across to the second campus. I chose to do that at recess, but prior to that, I spent 30 years in the Visiting Teacher Service, which still exists, and that's where teachers of students with disabilities travel to three or four schools a day.
It's vital. There was a period where it looked like schools were going to lose that resource, and the outcry, and rightly so, was incredible.
Yes, well, I think I was part of that in terms of giving advice to my ex-colleagues. How to talk to radio and other media to sort of publicise this.
Good on you. Getting specialist teachers into regional areas is a whole other conversation, but if it's about pooling resources and finding a way to formalise that, I want this to work in theory. A little part of me just has red flags, like this text that says it's a great idea as long as it doesn't become a way to just casualise the workforce. Well, Adam Voigt is the CEO of Real Schools. Adam, I see so many positives, and I see at the same time, I see so many ways for this not to work and for it to become a way to not get teachers into areas permanently, for the system to become just full of casual teachers and to not get specialists permanently into schools. There's two sides to this. What's your gut feeling on the concept?
I think my gut feeling, Rochelle, is pretty similar to yours. It's sort of this cautious optimism.
Yeah.
I think that there's an opportunity here for schools to collaborate more and to experiment. We have to be open to the idea that these experiments sometimes will fail. They'll try new things and it won't work. They'll say, okay, we actually learned that, and that's just as valuable as when it does work. So we need schools trying these new things and working together. We've got a system in Australia that has encouraged competition between schools for such a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they not only hoard resources, but they hoard good practices and things that could
and
work
teachers.
And could be taken to scale and teachers. And so where we've got goodwill on the ground, where we've got teachers who want to do this work, like you just spoke to Gail then about, you know, somebody who really loved being able to travel between schools, where for some teachers they're going to say, no, I want the structure of my school and consistency, and I don't want to waste my teaching time travelling. Where we've got that goodwill, then there's great opportunity here. We can focus on what does good actual teaching between the classrooms look like, and maybe worry a little less about whether we're sharing
changing culture though. And you're so right in that natural competitive nature that schools have, from NAPLAN results to, you know, poaching teachers. Will it stop teachers moving to schools who are seen to be, you know, performing well and staying at schools where they're possibly needed more?
Well, it could, and that's where one of the really interesting potentials in this lies, is when we can get, you know, we kind of know at a classroom level, Rochelle, that the classroom cohesion works well and kids perform well individually when kind of my success depends on yours. When you've got a kid who's really good at maths helping the kid who's struggling with a certain concept, that happens at scale with schools too. So we've got a school that's going really well, but now they suddenly care about the performance of the school a few kilometres away. That has significant potential. Like I said, it's this human energy thing that we've got to cater for. You know, so we can talk about how good it is that we've got, you know, teachers moving from school to school teaching different subjects because they're good at it. But we also have got to go, okay, there's some amazing research that's come out recently from overseas that looping in schools, which is effectively just having a group of kids stay with the same teacher for 2 years instead of one, you know, is that significantly improves student learning outcomes.
That's an interesting concept, because every year you feel like you have to pass on, even though teachers do pass on knowledge to the next teacher, you do sometimes, especially when your kids are young, feel like you have to really go in and advocate and say, right, are you across this? You know, this is an issue, and you feel like a bit of a broken record sometimes.
That's right. Every teacher will tell you that there are certain kids and cohorts you work with who you get, it's only about halfway through term three that you go, I get these guys now. Mm. Yeah, I know how to make this work with these guys. And then you hand them over 10 weeks later. So
that's an interesting concept. I'm sort of jumping to another topic now, but so how many schools do that where you have the same teacher for 2 years?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you exactly how many do it, but there are some schools that are experimenting with approaches like this. And I think that's really a cool idea behind this, is that maybe this isn't just about sharing teachers, but it's about sharing approaches, you know, for the way that we work together. And what if these group of schools, helped by, like Mike mentioned, some leaders who are skilled in helping schools collaborate, you know, sitting sort of above the group of schools, do that? How can they do that well? I think the risk that we face is that group of leaders above them becomes a bureaucracy when we are talking, like Mike mentioned, out to 50 schools, becomes an organisational bureaucracy.
That's what worries me.
They tend to kind of decide what best practice is.
Yeah.
When we're not running an experiment now, we're trying to confirm an ideology.
Yeah.
And that's no good for anyone.
That's where my cynical hat comes on, where all of a sudden, someone comes in who has never walked into a school classroom and says, here's best practice, when in actual fact, they have no idea what best practice is. But if it is a true and proper think tank for people in that community who know what best practice is, then that could be really exciting and game-changing. We got a text. Adam Voigt is with you, the CEO of Real Schools. This is from Dr. Tony, who says, I'm an Aussie education academic. However, I'm currently in Lapland and Finland, and I think that this UK model allows rapid capacity building in schools and broader learning and subject experience for students. Particularly in remote areas, students can engage with subjects and experts that they may not otherwise have available. So it feels like there is a real global shift towards this. Adam, do you reckon Victoria will trial what Tassie's trialling?
I think it's possible. I know plenty of principals here who, given the opportunity to work with some other local schools, to actually, you know, particularly when there's like a bit of geographic distance helps with the resources, not too much geographic distance helps with kind of, these are our kind of kids. You know, so if we know our kind of kids and those groups of schools are working together, and if they're supported to try different things, and if they're supported to, you know, try it and, as I mentioned, fail, you know, it's okay to try a new approach and go, oh, that didn't work so well. You know, it isn't a failure of the system in that regard. It actually it generated something that's really valuable for us moving forward. So if we support them to put this important human energy behind it, if they think there are good ideas and we can help take those things to scale, rather than have them, you know, hiding away, or we found a great way to teach Year 5's maths, but we don't want to tell anyone because we need our NAPLAN results up this year because that sustains our enrolment, because that sustains our funding. If we can get rid of a bit of that for this kind of practice, yeah, there's some wins to be made.
Yeah, absolutely. Gosh, it will change the vibe of NAPLAN dramatically, I reckon, as schools take it up, and that's a good thing. Adam, thank you. I'm going to pick your brain another time about this same teacher for 2 years business, because I think there's a lot to discuss there. Good on you.
That sounds good, Rochelle. Talk to you then.
See ya. Adam Voigt, CEO of Real Schools. And I wonder how it would help with school refusal, or school can't, as it's called now. There's a text here saying, my grandson has school refusal due to what we think was a mismatch with his teacher that he had last year. Yet this year, so far, so good. So I wonder whether it would help with that. Franco's in Wangaratta. What did you want to share?
What I wanted to share was that the program that you're discussing at the moment has actually worked. We've had it in the Catholic education system in the Sandhurst Diocese for a number of years. But unfortunately, with redirection of funds, we no longer have the ability to do that. We used to meet regularly as language teachers, because that's my specialty area. And we used to do a lot of sharing, a lot of coordinating, a lot of networking. And I think, particularly being in a regional area, it really helped teachers not to feel that isolation feeling that often we do feel.
So
and a lot of things have come out of it.
So I guess due to lack of funding, did you say, or a redirection of funds?
Redirection,
so what
funds
makes it expensive? Like, why does it need significant funds?
We had a person from the Catholic Education Office that did all the administration of, you know, running the meetings, networking and contacting schools and language teachers. So she was the kingpin, if you like, that brought us all together. But due to redirections of funding, that's no longer available, and we've had to sort of pretty much be left on our own devices. We do have a language teacher group in the northeast of Victoria, which does a little bit of the work. We meet on a regular basis. And look, this sharing thing is very, very important, because we're able to see what the needs of the teachers are, and we can call in experts as necessary. Mm. And that's what used to happen.
Yeah. And just finally, Franco, I mean, when we were talking to Adam Voigt from Real Schools, he was saying that fundamentally we're really competitive here, school against school. You know, we want to be seen to be performing better. There's another text that's saying we've got a really competitive education system where all of the sectors compete against each other for, you know, highest VCE results or NAPLAN results. We just don't encourage cooperation between schools. Did this break that down when the model was working for you? Did the competitive nature disappear to a certain degree?
I don't think there was any competition from the outset, because as language, as teachers of languages, we really only have one aim in mind. So there's really no competition between schools. We're there to improve the outcomes of students, and that's always been the first thing to consider.
Yeah.
So I would say there wasn't competition.
Good.
So I couldn't
say you're lucky.
Whether. Yeah, that's right.
Good on you, Franco. Really good to get your thoughts. Wow. It's interesting, isn't it? We'll try and get back to more of these calls and texts a little later in the program. But coming up next, have you ever been trapped inside your car? Someone else from the car walks out with the keys. You stay in the car for whatever reason, only to discover you can't get out.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Keep those calls and texts coming through, and whether or not you share resources with other schools, or maybe you would like to share resources with other schools, would that stop the competitive nature that maybe we have in this state? But do we need to bring door handles and door locks, like old school manual door handles and door locks, back into cars? Because have you ever been kind of trapped inside your car? You know, you've been sitting in the car with someone else, they've popped into the shops, taken the keys with them, then you've tried to get out only to discover that you cannot open the door. Well, as more and more cars become super fancy and super tech, there is some growing concerns that maybe it's not safe. And in particular with some EVs, where the reliance is on screens and on technology, do we need to actually look at how we can and cannot open our doors? Riz Akhtar is the Victorian Director of the Australian EV Association. Riz, I mean, some people are saying this is a big issue and concern for electric vehicles. However, I've had a mate stuck inside a car in an old school petrol car. So is it just about how fancy our door handles and our knobs are disappearing in cars? Is this actually an issue?
Rochelle, very, very good point, because there's obviously a lot of change happening, as you mentioned, in the car industry with the amount of tech that's coming into place. I think it's something that, you know, we do need to be aware of, but it's an issue that I think is not specifically towards electric vehicles only. It's a general trend. Cars are becoming far more techy than what they used to. It's just electric cars are at the cutting edge of, you know, what this tech revolution is.
Oh, you're seeing a shift back, though, in EVs to what we would think of as old-fashioned cars, you know, cars that we grew up in, like actual door handles?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got so many options in the Australian market, and, yeah, we are getting brand-new EVs with physical door handles, which, you know, people are used to, and it's making people feel more comfortable with those cars. So there's definitely a shift going on there.
Is it dangerous in some models? Because there has been sort of some discussion around electrical signalling in EVs when that car loses power. And I've had this happen to me in an electric car where the entire screen shut down and I had no idea if I was in park or drive or reverse. And it was really quite, it's quite scary, actually. But the idea of if you lose power after a collision, or God forbid, if the car ends up in water, that the door mechanisms don't work, that they're not able to function. Is that at all an issue?
Look, it's, you know, it's never easy when, like you said, if you're relying on a screen and the screen shuts down, you don't know if it's in park or not. That is scary. A lot of the vehicles do have some sort of a manual system on top of that. They have a safety override as well. Some of the new models that are coming out of China, for example, where they don't even have proper keys. You walk up to the door and the door opens. You get in the car, you press the brake pedal, and the door closes. But even those vehicles have manual override in case that there is a cut to the power source or anything like that. Those same cars have also been proven or submerged in water, like literally driving into a lake as part of a test to see what happens.
Oh my God.
And they do release their doors, and there's other mechanisms in there to allow people to be able to get out. Not every car has that, and I would like to see more cars go towards a manual override as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that feels like something that just should be by law. I mean, you're drawing the short straw if you're having to do that test and drive the car into the lake. But is that something that you predict will change, where Australian laws will make things like that mandatory?
Australia is, of course, we try and follow with the automotive industry most of whatever the global requirements are, because we don't make any cars here anymore. Interestingly, earlier this week, the Chinese automotive industry and the government there has set a new benchmark where they say you must have physical door handles from the 1st of January 2027. Mm. And they need to have a certain amount of force, 500 Newton benchmark test needs to be applied for the door to be open. But that's for vehicles that are going to be produced from 1st of January next year. And this includes things like Teslas that we get in our market, because they are also made in China for the Australian market. So all of those cars will need to comply as well. Having said that, we also have to, you know, look at our local safety testing, such as ANCAP. And last month, both Tesla's Model 3 and Model Y received ANCAP's Best in Class Award for the safest cars they've ever tested. I guess our regulators are keeping on top of some of these changes, but maybe this manual door handle release is not part of their criteria.
I'm so happy to hear that door handles are coming back. There's nothing more bizarre than sitting in a car and having to turn to someone and say, how do I get out? And you just have no idea. Riz, thank you. Good to get your thoughts. Riz Akhtar, the Victorian Director of the Australian EV Association. This text, Rish, is a rampant claustrophobic. I find it terrifying, the thought of being locked in the car. In fact, if someone else is driving and they get out, I always open the window. I know, isn't it funny how you have things like that? I'm like that with any kind of public toilet. If I can't find a way to crawl out of the public toilet or climb over, then I don't lock the door. I'm like, oh, I would prefer someone to walk in on me sitting on the loo than the idea of being locked in the toilet and not being able to get out. Must be a little too much information, but there you go. We've been talking about schools and whether or not we should be sharing resources, not just pools and basketball courts, but teachers, creating a think tank across multiple schools, and in particular for regional areas and really small schools. Do you think it's a good idea? Some schools are already doing it. Steve's in East Gippsland. G'day, Steve.
Oh, hi there. I just thought that sharing teachers between schools, if it's done honestly and properly, could mean, for example, that specialist teachers like music teachers could then become full-time employees of the education department or a group of schools and have proper career progression and predictability. They know where they're going to teach and who they're going to teach for the next year. And it means that, for example, if you're teaching music to students in three different schools, you could then pull an orchestra together from three different schools. And instead of this ridiculous business of zero-hour contracts where people are on sessional teaching where they're only paid for the minutes they're in front of a class, which should be banned in all industries anyway.
You've thought about this, Steve. To the point where you're like, you could put orchestras together from multiple schools. I mean, are you a music teacher, Steve?
No, but I've had the privilege of having the benefit of being taught by a music teacher, and I've seen the amount of work and time she's had to waste getting work in half a dozen different unrelated schools.
And specialist teachers across the board, this could work for. So it could be language, it could be music, it could be visual arts, performing arts.
It could be chemistry. It could be sport. It could be, because at the moment schools have generalist teachers. So you end up with a teacher who's never been a real scientist, all of a sudden keeping half a page ahead of the book instead of having a science teacher.
Yeah, I know. It's disturbing, isn't it? And then PE, that's another one as well.
Yeah.
And you could put a basketball team together.
And in regional areas, I mean, how many teachers who live in the city would love to go out to the country on Wednesday night, teach for 2 days on Thursday and Friday, and then go sailing on the local lake or riding the bike up the local rail trail or whatever? That'd be brilliant.
Steve, you need to work in advertising, in tourism.
Well, East Gippsland, a classic case. Anybody with any sense would choose to live in East Gippsland, but we'd find it difficult to get professionals because they've been brainwashed by living in the city.
Oh, yeah, talking to a Gippsland girl, Steve. So you're preaching to the converted. Good on you, mate. Thank you. Amanda's called through. Good morning, Amanda.
Oh, good morning, Rochelle.
What do you think?
About the schools, yeah, so I live in inner Melbourne, and I think that this type of scheme could maybe really help with equity amongst schools, because I think we see in inner Melbourne a bit of a concentration of socioeconomic privilege in certain schools and then different circumstances 100%. In other schools. And so something I think that would just break that down and have families really have that confidence that any school they send their child to, they're going to have a great education and a great experience. And
how incredible would that be?
Equity. Yeah. Well, it would be, right? But it shouldn't be incredible. It should be something we expect in a first world country. But I think in Australia, particularly in Melbourne, we have a lot of socioeconomic barriers around schooling driven by property prices and
school zones, like, and what it does to properties. And then, you know, you're right, Amanda, in that every now and then, you know, you'll hear of a principal that's come in and has transformed a school that was, you know, underperforming and the kids were at risk, and it took this one principal, which is great. I'm not saying it's not, but that shouldn't be a standout, you know, school.
No,
there should be an equality.
Sister Act, right? Like, I think this should be something we should expect and advocate for in our, you know, relatively wealthy society.
Amanda,
so I think if this can help break that down, that's a really positive thing for our state.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I love this, Rochelle. All public toilets must be designed so that the door can be lifted off safely for reasons, say, if a person had a heart attack in a cubicle. Okay, thank you, but what if no one's there, right? What if I just get stuck in the toilet? Surely I'm not the only one that's scared of getting stuck in public toilets. Do you also check if you can, you know, crawl out underneath or crawl over? And as a result, if you can't, you keep the door open. You know, hand there.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Steve in East Gippsland, if you're still listening, people are in love with you, my friend. Steve, for Education Minister, says this text. His ideas were brilliant. These are great ideas. We should be sharing the resources. And Boyd sent this. My wife bought Christmas presents for the family, and it was a little handheld shock hammer that breaks the glass to allow you to get out in an emergency. It's also supposed to cut the safety belt. I hope we never have to use them. Well, that's quite the Christmas present, isn't it? If you ever get stuck in the car, here's a little Shawshank Redemption-esque hammer to help you get out. I don't know, I mean, for many of us, we panic going over big bridges, you know, like the bridge from San Remo to Phillip Island. As you go over it, you're like, okay, we made it to the other side. Although Boyd and his family, they got their little shock hammers to get out of it. So many of you, you won't be surprised to hear that I was at an op shop just recently, and my daughter's become a very fine op shopper as well. And she picked up something and asked me, "Mum, what's this?" And what she was holding was a fashion pattern. So you know the ones, they were in white envelopes. There was a sketch, a fashion sketch, a colourful fashion sketch on the front. And as kids, you know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, my nan, my aunties, my friends' mums, they all had heaps of these patterns, sometimes boxes of fashion patterns. Maybe you've still got some yourself now. Maybe you still use fashion patterns. Well, you might be sitting on a gold mine, because there's really only one main supplier of these fashion patterns, and they've just gone into liquidation. So all of the major craft stores that hold these patterns, they actually do it sort of on a consignment type process where basically the supplier pays them and you only pay the supplier once you've sold them. But now they've said you've got to just either buy all of these patterns or destroy them. So there's probably not going to be many of these patterns now made anymore, and it's going to be really, really hard to be able to buy them. So does that matter? I mean, do you use these patterns now? Are you downloading them from the internet, or are you still using these physical fashion patterns? Paola Di Trocchio is a fashion historian. Paola, they're quite beautiful. I mean, they almost tell a story of a particular style and era. Even the fact that we sort of don't have fashion illustrators like we once had. Does it matter if no one's no longer making and designing these fashion patterns?
It's interesting, isn't it? I agree. The artwork on the front is often really, really gorgeous. But in terms of not making them anymore, absolutely. I feel like they're archive. They're an archive of sewing techniques, historical sewing techniques, because, of course, clothes were made differently in the 50s versus in the early 19th century versus in the 1970s, and there's different fits and different cuts and different patterns and different aspects to these patterns. So, yeah, they really are an archive of dressmaking techniques. So
and given that just one company who's now gone into liquidation makes the majority of these patterns, if they're no longer making them and they've said to the suppliers, look, you either have to buy all of these patterns off us because you've had them on consignment or destroy them, I think to the point where one retailer has said they've told them that they need to give photo evidence that they've destroyed these patterns, which is really, it's quite heartbreaking to think about, actually. So what then happens? I can't imagine someone's going to take up the slack there and say, I'm going to go into the pattern making business.
Well, interestingly, there are a number of small makers. It's a bit of a niche area. I don't know how many there are, but I do know that I was probably a couple of years ago at a dinner with someone who was based in the US, and that was her business. She made, she sort of drafted patterns that she sold to an audience. So I think online places like Etsy or these kind of online communities and a much more, it's almost turning full circle back to a kind of grassroots industry where people are making and supplying. And there's also a pattern making school in Melbourne that's actually growing, providing services to home dressmakers as well as really established Australian fashion labels in order to perfect, craft, refine their pattern making, or for home sewers to learn how to make patterns themselves.
Pattern making is harder than one would think, and I speak from experience. I decided I wanted to try my hand at something in the fashion industry, and I enrolled in a couple of courses, and one of them was pattern design and pattern making, and it was supposed to be over like 6 weeks, you know, six classes over 6 weeks, and I got about 30 minutes into the first lesson and said, look, I'm sorry, this is a mathematics class and I need to not be here and
it is,
left.
It is mathematics, and I would imagine that it takes a lot longer than 6 weeks to refine as well. But, I mean, that's one of the beauty of those home sewing patterns, that they provide a basis and then the more you use them, I guess if anyone's a home sewer, they probably know what I'm talking about, you start to manipulate them and play with them and, you know, add one part to another part and work
and manipulate them to your size. So that, you know, 100%. You might be a size 12 up the top but a size 14 down the bottom and be able to mix them around. Paola, stay with us. Pam's in Wood End. Hi, Pam.
Hello.
Do you have some of these beautiful old patterns?
I have absolute drawfuls of them and I'm absolutely devastated. I found out this week that this has all happened.
Yeah.
And so I'm really, really at a loss because I too have tried doing pattern drafting. And it isn't as easy as...
No, it's hard,
you.
Pam.
And I did a couple of courses. There are a couple of really good organisations doing it, and I congratulate them for doing that. But if you just want to whip something up in the course of a weekend, having to draft the pattern is just going to add so much more time to that.
So you and, still buy them, Pam?
I do. I usually buy them when they're on sale, of course. Because some of the Vogue patterns were really quite expensive when you look at the cost of the garment and everything. Because, again, even fabric is harder to source these days. You don't have the same old Clegg's fabrics and the like that we used to have that used to bring in a full range of product rather than the odd bits that we get from factory overruns now and things like that.
How far back do your patterns go, Pam? I got a text here saying I've still got all my patterns back from 1979.
I hadn't started sewing at that point. I started sewing probably in the mid-80s, so some of mine go back that far. I don't fit into them anymore, but...
pass them on.
Pass them on, or one day I may learn how to be able to adapt them. I'm absolutely devastated that this has happened, because we don't have another really high volume option like that. We've got some indie patterns and things like that that are doing interesting stuff, but it's not like I had a wedding to go to late last year, and I made a satin gown for that wedding, and a lot of the indie patterns don't cover that part of it. So you know, it's really we really don't have another option.
Yeah, so such a shame, Pam. I'm so envious and jealous that you can sew, and you're such a beautiful sewer as well. Do you think Paola Di Trocchio is with you, a fashion historian and writer? Paola, as Pam was saying, she's like, oh, God, what am I going to do now? This is how I make my clothes. I wonder whether there'll probably be a sellout of some of these patterns, because it sort of is the one main supplier, and, yeah, whether someone will pick up the slack, who knows?
Well, I hope so, but I guess in the meantime there's a whole lot of people with patterns in their drawers, and maybe it's just the secondhand market. But even then, we sort of need innovation.
Well, maybe this is it. Michelle's in Oakley. Michelle, you've got a good idea.
Yeah, I just think we should have pattern libraries, the same as we borrow library books and other resources from the libraries. Why don't we have the patterns there as well?
Why don't we? What a great idea.
I know when I was a child, the mums, the nanas, the aunties, they were all sharing around patterns back then, you know, so why can't we do
Weren't
that?
Weren't they? I remember my Auntie Isabel would come over to my nana's house with a copy of, you know, the new idea and the patterns that they were swapping. And in Traff, it was a real, they were ahead of their time. Everyone swapped their patterns.
That's right. So why, you know, I can see local councils buying up these stocks and providing another service for residents, because lots of people are looking at using, you know, making their own clothes again during the cost of living crisis and recycling. And lots of people do have fabric stashed away for, you know, you think that you'll get to use it and you don't. And I think it's a great opportunity.
Can you sew? Michelle?
Not very well.
You can't sew either, Paola?
Me? No, I can sew.
Oh, okay. I can't. I'm terrible. I wish I could sew.
I can do some mending, and I used to do a lot of dance costume decoration, but I can't really sew. I did do a course, but it really wasn't for me.
Isn't that a skill, dance costume decorating, the bedazzlers, a lot of fringing? I'm thinking lycra. Yep. Sewing lycra, that's a skill, Michelle.
It really is. And then there's tutus. Making tutus is a whole other world.
Oh, wow. What a good mum you are. Dance mum.
I'm done with all of that now. One of the originals, yeah.
One of the originals. I know my mum did it as well. And so did Christy's mum. She was a sewer, and she would always make our little dance costumes. This, Rochelle, my mum had a fashion drawer in Germany. She also bought fashion patterns that were children's and sewed children's clothes for her daughters, herself, as well as beautiful dresses, suits in different fabrics like satin for women who couldn't sew themselves. Mum also learned tips from her mum-in-law, who was a tailor, who knew how to cut and sew and to make things that fitted perfectly. Marissa's in Box Hill. Good morning. Have you sitting on a gold mine of patterns, fashion patterns?
No, not myself. But I do have good memories of going to the haberdashery store with my mum and sitting up on the big stools. They used to have like high table, like almost like bars with the massive books that you'd flick through. And, choosing my ball dress. Kind of modelled on Lady Diana's wedding dress.
Oh, nice.
raw silk. You know, emerald green raw silk.
Oh, I can remember it now, yes.
It was magnificent.
And being able to pick it out, it was a different way of going shopping, Paola, wasn't it? Picking out your fashion pattern was shopping, essentially.
Absolutely. It was amazing, because you would choose the kind of sketch of the silhouette that would suit your body or, you know, the style or whoever you wanted to be, like Princess Diana. And then you got to choose the colour and the texture of the fabric. And there were so many creative choices involved in deciding what that item was going to be. It's really quite magical. And it's a real exercise in the imagination. It's not just, you know, going to a shop and being limited with what is there. There's a real aspect of an element of choice to it of, you know, I want it a little bit more narrow here. I want these sleeves a bit puffier. I want it in purple instead of green.
Oh, don't we always want the sleeves puffier? And what, the bigger, the better. And, I mean, it was interesting in knowing about today's story, the more I thought about it, the sort of the sadder I felt because we're living in a period where we don't want fast fashion, where we want the skill, we want the creativity, and people want their own fashion sense. And then it turns out that not every school is even teaching sewing as a basic now. And if we don't have these patterns, it feels like the wrong time, just finally, Paola, to lose this as a resource, because without this one company, there's probably not going to be many left.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky. I mean, I spent my 20s working at Lincraft, and it meant that, you know, every weekend I was making clothes for myself to wear out. So there's a real kind of enabling excitement about being able to make whatever you want. But there, at the same time, there were the, you know, classes at school that enabled me to do it. But I guess what we need is a demand from people in order to make it happen.
So thank you, Paola. Yeah, it needs to be there. Yeah, good to speak with you. Thank you, Paola Di Trocchio, fashion historian and writer. Quickly to Vicky in Coburg. If you're quick, Vicky, morning.
Oh, Rochelle, I was at Coburg Library a couple of days ago and they've got a room of sewing machines.
Oh, what?
So having patterns there as a pattern library would work really well.
Wow. Are you a good sewer, Vicky?
No, my mum was, so I'm not.
Yeah, I know. There was always someone in your household or in your sort of 6 degrees that was a really, really good sewer, and you'd go to them and they would take something up for you or they would do it. But Jan in Ballarat says, I can remember some time ago our local Spotlight store actually used to rack up your breakable purchases in the tissue-like paper that the patterns were made from just to try and use them up. Wow. Well, it's a sad day if we can no longer buy fashion patterns. Not that I know how to even sew a button on, but it doesn't mean that I don't like to look at those pretty fashion patterns. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.